than watching your mom die over and over? Well, that's just a horrible routine by now. It's a bad dream I have every so often. No, this was just surreal. He runs his hand over my belly. I went forward, and I was really there, you know, coming in strong. And I ran into our little girl here. Oh my God, I'm so jealous. But wow. Yeah, she was about 10. Claire, she is so amazing. She's smart and musical and just really confident, and nothing fazed her. What does she look like? Me. A girl version of me. I mean, she's beautiful. She's got your eyes, but basically she looks a lot like me. Black hair, pale with a few freckles, and her mouth is smaller than mine was, and her ears don't stick out. She had long curly hair, and my hands with the long fingers, and she's tall. She was like a young cat. Perfect. Perfect. I'm afraid my genes have had their way with her. She was like you with personality, though. She had the most amazing presence. I saw her in a group of school children at the Art Institute, and she was talking about Joseph Cornell's aviary boxes, and she said something heartrending about him. And somehow, I knew who she was. And she recognized me. Well, I would hope so. I have to ask. Does she... Is she... Henry hesitates. Yes, he finally says. She does. We are both silent. He strokes my face. I know. I want to cry. Claire, she seemed happy. I asked her. She said she likes it. He smiles. She said it was interesting. We both laugh. A little ruefully at first, and then it hits me. And we laugh in earnest until our faces hurt, until tears are streaming down our cheeks. Because, of course, it is interesting. Very interesting.
Birthday. Wednesday, September 5th and Thursday, September 6th, 2001. Henry is 38, Claire is 30. Claire has been pacing around the house all day like a tiger. The contractions come every 20 minutes or so. Try to get some sleep, I tell her, and she lies on the bed for a few minutes and then gets up again. At 2 in the morning, she finally goes to sleep. I lie next to her, wakeful, watching her breathe, listening to the little fretful sound she makes, playing with her hair. I'm worried, even though I know, even though I have seen with my own eyes that she'll be okay, and Alba will be okay. Claire wakes up at 3:30. I want to go to the hospital, she tells me. Maybe we should call a cab, I say. It's awfully late. Gomez said to call no matter what time it was. Okay. I dial Gomez and Charisse. The phone rings 16 times, and then Gomez picks up, sounding like a man on the bottom of the sea. Ugh, says Gomez. Hey, comrade, it's time. He mutters something that sounds like mustard eggs. Then Charisse gets on the phone and tells me that they're on their way. I hang up and call Dr. Montague and leave a message with her answering service. Claire is crouched on all fours, rocking back and forth. I get down on the floor with her. Claire? She looks up at me, still rocking. Henry, why did we decide to do this again? Supposedly, when it's over, they hand you a baby and let you keep it. Oh, yeah. 15 minutes later, we're climbing into Gomez's Volvo. Gomez yawns as he helps me maneuver Claire into the back seat. Do not even think of drenching my car in amniotic fluid, he says to Claire amiably. Charisse runs into the house for garbage bags and covers the seats. We hop in and away we go. Claire leans against me and clenches my hands in hers. Don't leave me, she says. I won't, I tell her. I meet Gomez's eyes in the rearview mirror. It hurts, Claire says. Oh, God, it hurts. Think of something else. Something nice, I say. We're racing down Western Avenue, headed south. There's hardly any traffic. Tell me. I cast about and come up with my most recent sojourn into Claire's childhood. Remember the day we went to the lake when you were 12? And we went swimming and you were telling me about getting your period? Claire is gripping my hands with bone-shattering strength.
Did I?
Yeah, you were sort of embarrassed, but also real proud of yourself. You were wearing a pink and green bikini and these yellow sunglasses with hearts molded into the frames.
I remember. Ah! Oh, Henry, it hurts! It hurts!
Charisse turns around and says, Come on, Claire, it's just the baby leaning on your spine. You've got to turn, okay? Claire tries to change her position.
Here we are, Gomez says, turning into Mercy Hospital's emergency unloading zone.
I'm leaking,
Claire says. Gomez stops the car, jumps out, and we gently remove Claire from the car. She takes two steps, and her water breaks.
Good timing, kitten, Gomez says.
Charisse runs ahead with our paperwork, and Gomez and I walk Claire slowly through ER and down long corridors to the OB wing. She stands leaning against the nurse's station while they nonchalantly prepare a room for her.
Don't leave me,
Claire whispers.
I won't, I tell her again. I wish I could be sure about this. I am feeling cold and a little nauseous.
Claire turns and leans into me. I wrap my arms around her. The baby is a hard roundness between us. Come out, wherever you are. Claire is panting. A fat blonde nurse comes and tells us the room is ready. We all troop in. Claire immediately gets down on the floor on her hands and knees. Charisse starts putting things away, clothes in the closet, toiletries in the bathroom. Gomez and I stand watching Claire helplessly. She's moaning. We look at each other. Gomez shrugs.
Charisse says, Hey Claire, how about a bath? You'll feel better in warm water.
Claire nods. Charisse makes a motion with her hands at Gomez that means shoo. Gomez says,
I think I'll go have a smoke,
and leaves. Should I stay? I ask Claire.
Yes, don't go. Stay where I can see you.
Okay.
I walk into the bathroom to run the water. Hospital bathrooms creep me out. They always smell like cheap soap and diseased flesh. I turn on the tap, wait for the water to get warm.
Henry, are you there?
Claire calls out. I stick my head back into the room.
I'm here.
Stay in here,
Claire commands, and Charisse takes my place in the bathroom. Claire makes a sound that I have never heard a human being make before. A deep, despairing groan of agony. What have I done to her? I think of 12-year-old Claire laughing and covered with wet sand on a blanket in her first bikini at the beach. Oh, Claire, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. An older black nurse comes in and checks Claire's cervix.
Good girl, she coos to Claire. 6 centimeters.
Claire nods, smiles, and then grimaces. She clutches her belly and doubles over, moaning louder. The nurse and I hold her. Claire gasps for breath and then starts to scream. Amit Montague walks in and rushes to her.
Baby, 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 hush.
The nurse is giving Dr. Montague a bunch of information that means nothing to me. Claire is sobbing. I clear my throat. My voice comes out in a croak.
How about an epidural?
Claire?
Claire nods. People crowd into the room with tubes and needles and machines. I sit holding Claire's hand, watching her face. She's lying on her side, whimpering, her face wet with sweat and tears as the anesthesiologist hooks up an IV and inserts a needle into her spine. Dr. Montague is examining her and frowning at the fetal monitor.
What's wrong?
Claire asks her.
Something's wrong.
The heartbeat is very fast. She is scared, you little girl. You have to be calm, Claire, so the baby can be calm. Yes?
It hurts so much.
That is because she is big.
Amit Montague's voice is quiet, soothing. The burly, walrus-mustachioed anesthesiologist looks at me, bored over Claire's body.
But now we are giving you a little cocktail, eh? Some narcotics, some analgesic. Soon you will relax, and the baby will relax, yes?
Claire nods yes. Dr. Montague smiles.
And Henry, how are you?
Not very relaxed. I try to smile. I could use some of whatever it is they're giving Claire. I'm experiencing slight double vision. I breathe deeply, and it goes away.
Things are improving, see?
Says Dr. Montague.
It is like a cloud that passes over. The pain goes away. We take it somewhere and leave it by the side of the road, all by itself. And you and the little one are still here, yes? It is pleasant here. We will take our time. There is no hurry.
The tension has left Claire's face. Her eyes are fixed on Dr. Montague. The machines beep. The room is dim. Outside, the sun is rising. Dr. Montague is watching the fetal monitor.
Tell her you are fine, and she is fine. Sing her a song, yes?
Alba, it's okay, Claire says softly. She looks at me.
Say the poem about the lovers on the carpet.
I blank. And then I remember. I feel self-conscious reciting Rilke in front of all these people, and so I begin.
Engel. Es wären ein Platz, den wir nicht wissen.
Say it in English. Claire interrupts.
Sorry.
I change my position so that I'm sitting by Claire's belly with my back to Charisse and the nurse and the doctor. I slide my hand under Claire's button-strained shirt. I can feel the outline of Alba through Claire's hot skin.
Angel, I say to Claire,
as though we are in our own bed, as though we've been up all night on less momentous errands.
Angel,
if there were a place that we didn't know of, and there, on some unsayable carpet, lovers displayed what they can never bring to mastery here, the bold exploits of their high-flying hearts, their towers of pleasure, their ladders that have long since been standing where there was no ground, leaning just on each other, trembling, and could master all this before the surrounding spectators, the innumerable soundless dead. Would these then throw down their final, forever saved up, forever hidden, unknown to us, eternally valid coins of happiness before the at last genuinely smiling pair on the gratified carpet?
There, says Dr. Montague, clicking off the monitor. Everyone is serene.
She beams at us all and glides us out the door, followed by the nurse. I accidentally catch the eye of the anesthesiologist, whose expression plainly says, What kind of pussy are you anyway?
The sun is coming up, and I am lying numb on this strange bed in this pink room. And somewhere in the foreign country that is my uterus, Alba is crawling toward home, or away from home. The pain has left, but I know that it has not gone far, that it is sulking somewhere in a corner or under the bed, and it will jump out when I least expect it. The contractions come and go, remote, muffled like the peal of bells through fog. Henry lies down next to me. People come and go. I feel like throwing up, but I don't. Charisse gives me shaved ice out of a paper cup. It tastes like stale snow. I watch the tubes and the red blinking lights, and I think about Mama. I breathe. Henry watches me. He looks so tense and unhappy. I start to worry again that he will vanish. It's okay, I say. He nods. He strokes my belly. I am sweating. It's so hot in here. The nurse comes in and checks on me. Amit checks on me. I am somehow alone with Alba in the midst of everyone. It's okay, I tell her. You're doing fine. You're not hurting me. Henry gets up and paces back and forth until I ask him to stop. I feel as though all my organs are becoming creatures, each with its own agenda, its own train to catch. Alba is tunneling headfirst into me, a bone-and-flesh excavator of my flesh and bone, a deepener of my depths. I imagine her swimming through me. I imagine her falling into the stillness of a morning pond, water parting at her velocity. I imagine her face. I want to see her face. I tell the anesthesiologist I want to feel something. Gradually, the numbness recedes and the pain comes back. But it's different pain now. It's okay pain. Time passes. Time passes and the pain begins to roll in and out, as though it's a woman standing at an ironing board, passing the iron back and forth across a white tablecloth. Amit comes in and says it's time. Time to go to the delivery room. I am shaved and scrubbed, and moved onto a gurney and rolled through hallways. I watch the ceilings of the hallways roll by, and Alba and I are rolling toward meeting each other, and Henry is walking beside us. In the delivery room, everything is green and white. I smell detergent. It reminds me of Etta, and I want Etta, but she is at Meadowlark. And I look up at Henry, who is wearing surgical scrubs, and I think, why are we here? We should be at home. And then I feel as though Alba is surging, rushing, and I push without thinking, and we do this again and again, like a game, like a song. Someone says, "Hey, where'd the dad go?" I look around, but Henry is gone. He is nowhere, not here, and I think, God damn him, but no, I don't mean it, God, but Alba is coming. She is coming, and then I see Henry. He stumbles into my vision, disoriented and naked, but here, he's here, and Amit says, Sacre Dieu, and then, ah, she is crowned, and I push, and Alba's head comes out, and I put my hand down to touch her head, her delicate, slippery, wet velvet head, and I push, and Alba tumbles into Henry's waiting hands, and someone says, oh, and I am empty and released, and I hear a sound like an old vinyl record when you put the needle in the wrong groove, and then Alba yells out, and suddenly she is here. Someone places her on my belly, and I look down, and her face, Alba's face, is so pink and creased, and her hair is so black, and her eyes blindly search, and her hands reach out, and Alba pulls herself up to my breasts, and she pauses, exhausted by the effort, by the sheer fact of everything. Henry leans over me and touches her forehead and says, Alba. Later. It's the evening of Alba's first day on Earth. I'm lying in bed in the hospital room surrounded by balloons and teddy bears and flowers with Alba in my arms. Henry is sitting cross-legged on the foot of the bed taking pictures of us. Alba has just finished nursing, and she blows colostrum bubbles from her tiny lips and then falls asleep, a soft, warm bag of skin and fluid against my nightgown. Henry finishes the roll of film and unloads the camera. Hey, I say, suddenly remembering, where did you go? In the delivery room? Henry laughs. You know, I was hoping you hadn't noticed that. I thought maybe you were so preoccupied. Where were you? I was wandering around my old elementary school in the middle of the night. For how long? I ask. Oh, God, hours. It was beginning to get light when I left. It was winter, and they had the heat turned way down. How long was I gone? I'm not sure. Maybe 5 minutes? Henry shakes his head. I was frantic. I mean, I had just abandoned you, and there I was just drifting around uselessly through the hallways of Francis Parker. It was so... I felt so... Henry smiles. But it turned out okay, hmm? I laugh. All's well that ends well. Thou speakest wiser than thou art whereof. There is a quiet knock on the door. Henry says, come in. And Richard steps into the room and then stops, hesitant. Henry turns and says, Dad, and then stops, and then jumps off the bed and says, come in, have a seat. Richard is carrying flowers and a small teddy bear, which Henry adds to the pile on the windowsill. Claire, says Richard, congratulations. He sinks slowly into the chair beside the bed. Would you like to hold her? Henry asks softly. Richard nods, looking at me to see if I agree. Richard looks as though he hasn't slept for days. His shirt needs ironing, and he stinks of sweat and the iodine reek of old beer. I smile at him, although I am wondering if this is such a hot idea. I hand Alba over to Henry, who carefully transfers her into Richard's awkward arms. Alba turns her pink round face up to Richard's long, unshaven one, turns toward his chest, and searches for a nipple. After a moment, she gives up and yawns, then goes back to sleep. He smiles. I had forgotten how Richard's smile can transform his face. She's beautiful, he tells me. And to Henry, She looks like your mother. Henry nods. There's your violinist, Dad. He smiles. It skipped a generation. A violinist? Richard looks down at the sleeping baby, black hair and tiny hands, fast asleep. No one ever looked less like a concert violinist than Alba does right now. A violinist. He shakes his head. But how do you... No, never mind. So you are a violinist, are you now, little girl? Alba sticks out her tongue a tiny bit and we all laugh. She'll need a teacher once she's old enough, I suggest. A teacher? Yes. You're not going to hand her over to those Suzuki idiots, are you? Richard demands. Henry coughs. Oh, actually, we were hoping that if you had nothing better to do... Richard gets it. It's a pleasure to see him comprehend, to see him realize that someone needs him, that only he can give his only granddaughter the training she will need. I'd be delighted, he says. And Alba's future unrolls in front of her like a red carpet, as far as the eye can see. Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. Claire is 30, Henry is 38. I wake up at 6:43 and Henry is not in bed. Alba isn't in her crib either. My breasts hurt. My cunt hurts. Everything hurts. I get out of bed very carefully, go to the bathroom. I walk through the hall, the dining room, slowly. In the living room, Henry is sitting on the couch with Alba cradled in his arms, not watching the little black and white television with the sound turned low. Alba is asleep. I sit down next to Henry. He puts his arm around me. How come you're up? I ask him. I thought you said it wasn't for a couple of hours yet. On the TV, a weatherman is smiling and pointing at a satellite picture of the Midwest. I couldn't sleep, Henry says. I wanted to listen to the world being normal for a little while longer. Oh. I lean my head on Henry's shoulder and close my eyes. When I open them again, a commercial for a cell phone company is ending, and a commercial for bottled water comes on. Henry hands Alba to me and gets up. In a minute, I hear him making breakfast. Alba wakes up, and I undo my nightgown and feed her. My nipples hurt. I watch the television. A blonde anchor person tells me something, smiling. He and the other anchor person, an Asian woman, laugh and smile at me. At City Hall, Mayor Daley is answering questions. I doze. Alba sucks at me. Henry brings in a tray of eggs, toast, and orange juice. I want coffee. Henry has tactfully drunk his in the kitchen, but I can smell it on his breath. He sets the tray on the coffee table and puts my plate on my lap. I eat my eggs as Alba nurses. Henry mops up the yolk with his toast. On TV, a bunch of kids are skidding across grass to demonstrate the effectiveness of some laundry detergent. We finish eating. Alba finishes too. I burp her, and Henry takes all the dishes to the kitchen. When he comes back, I pass her to him and head to the bathroom. I take a shower. The water is so hot, I almost can't stand it, but it feels heavenly on my sore body. I breathe the steamy air, dry my skin gingerly, rub balm on my lips, breasts, stomach. The mirror is all steamed up, so I don't have to see myself. I comb my hair. I pull on sweatpants and a sweater. I feel deformed, deflated. In the living room, Henry is sitting with his eyes closed, and Alba is sucking her thumb. As I sit down again, Alba opens her eyes and makes a mewing sound. Her thumb slips out of her mouth, and she looks confused. A jeep is driving through a desert landscape. Henry has turned off the sound. He massages his eyes with his fingers. I fall asleep again. Henry says, "Wake up, Claire." I open my eyes. The television picture swerves around. A city street. A sky. a white skyscraper on fire. An airplane, toy-like, slowly flies into the second white tower. Silent flames shoot up. Henry turns up the sound. "Oh my God," says the voice of the television. "Oh my God." Tuesday, June 11th, 2002. Claire is 31. I'm making a drawing of Alba. At this moment, Alba is 9 months and 5 days old. She is sleeping on her back, on a small, light blue flannel blanket, on the yellow ochre and magenta Chinese rug on the living room floor. She has just finished nursing. My breasts are light, almost empty. Alba is so very asleep that I feel perfectly okay about walking out the back door and across the yard into my studio. For a minute, I stand in the doorway, inhaling the slightly musty, unused studio odor. Then I rummage around in my flat file, find some persimmon-tanned paper that looks like cowhide, grab a few pastels and other implements and a drawing board and walk, with only a small pang of regret, out the back door and back into the house. The house is very quiet. Henry is at work, I hope, and I can hear the washing machine churning away in the basement. The air conditioner whines. There's a faint rumble of traffic on Lincoln Avenue. I sit down on the rug next to Alba. A trapezoid of sunlight is inches away from her small, pudgy feet. In half an hour, it will cover her. I clip my paper to the drawing board and arrange my pastels next to me on the rug. Pencil in hand, I consider my daughter. Alba is sleeping deeply. Her rib cage rises and falls slowly, and I can hear the soft grunt she makes with each exhalation. I wonder if she's getting a cold. It's warm in here on this June late afternoon, and Alba's wearing a diaper and nothing else. She's a little flushed. Her left hand is clenching and unclenching rhythmically. Maybe she's dreaming music. I begin to rough in Alba's head, which is turned toward me. I am not thinking about this, really. My hand is moving across the paper like the needle of a seismograph, recording Alba's form as I absorb it with my eyes. I note the way her neck disappears in the folds of baby fat under her chin, how the soft indentations above her knees alter slightly as she kicks once and is still again. My pencil describes the convexity of Alba's full belly, which submerges into the top of her diaper, an abrupt and angular line cutting across her roundness. I study the paper, adjust the angle of Alba's legs, redraw the crease where her right arm joins her torso. I begin to lay in pastel. I start by sketching in highlights in white, down her tiny nose, along her left side, across her knuckles, her diaper, the edge of her left foot. Then I rough in shadows, in dark green and ultramarine. A deep shadow clings to Alba's right side where her body meets the blanket. It's like a pool of water, and I put it in solidly. Now the Alba in the drawing suddenly becomes three-dimensional, leaps off the page. I use two pink pastels, a light pink, the hue of the inside of a shell, and a dark pink that reminds me of raw tuna. With rapid strokes, I make Alba's skin. It is as though Alba's skin was hidden in the paper, and I am removing some invisible substance that concealed it. Over this pastel skin, I use a cool violet to make Alba's ears and nose and mouth. Her mouth is slightly open in a tiny O. Her black and abundant hair becomes a mixture of dark blue and black and red on the paper. I take care with her eyebrows, which seem so much like furry caterpillars that have found a home on Alba's face. The sunlight covers Alba now. She stirs, brings her small hand over her eyes and sighs. I write her name and my name and the date at the bottom of the paper. The drawing is finished. It will serve as a record. I loved you. I made you. And I made this for you. Long after I am gone, and Henry is gone, and even Alba is gone, it will say, "We made you. And here you are, here and now. Alba opens her eyes and smiles. Secret. Sunday, October 12th, 2003. Claire is 32. Henry is 40. This is a secret. Sometimes I am glad when Henry is gone. Sometimes I enjoy being alone. Sometimes I walk through the house late at night, and I shiver with the pleasure of not talking, not touching, just walking, or sitting, or taking a bath. Sometimes I lie on the living room floor and listen to Fleetwood Mac, the Bengals, the B-52s, the Eagles, bands Henry can't stand. Sometimes I go for long walks with Alba, and I don't leave a note saying where I am. Sometimes I meet Celia for coffee, and we talk about Henry and Ingrid and whoever Celia's seeing that week. Sometimes I hang out with Charisse and Gomez, and we don't talk about Henry, and we manage to enjoy ourselves. Once I went to Michigan, and when I came back, Henry was still gone, and I never told him I had been anywhere. Sometimes I get a babysitter and go to the movies, or I ride my bicycle after dark along the bike path by Montrose Beach with no lights. It's like flying. Sometimes I am glad when Henry's gone, but I'm always glad when he comes back.
Experiencing technical difficulties. Friday, May 7th, 2004. Henry is 40, Claire is 32. We are at the opening of Claire's exhibit at the Chicago Cultural Center. She's been working nonstop for a year, building huge ethereal bird skeletons out of wire, wrapping them in translucent strips of paper, coating them with shellac until they transmit light. Now the sculptures hang from the high ceiling and squat on the floor. Some of them are kinetic, motorized. A few beat their wings, and there are two cock skeletons slowly demolishing each other in a corner. An 8-foot-tall pigeon dominates the entrance. Claire is exhausted and ecstatic. She's wearing a simple black silk dress. Her hair is piled high on her head. People have brought her flowers. She has a bouquet of white roses in her arms. There's a heap of plastic-wrapped bouquets next to the guest book. It's very crowded. People circle around, exclaim over each piece, crane their heads back to look at the flying birds. Everyone congratulates Claire. There was a glowing review in this morning's Tribune. All our friends are here, and Claire's family is driven in from Michigan. They surround Claire now. Philip, Alicia, Mark and Sharon and their kids, Nell, Etta. Charisse takes pictures of them, and they all smile for her. When she gives us copies of the pictures a few weeks from now, I'll be struck by the dark circles under Claire's eyes and by how thin she looks. I'm holding Alba's hand. We stand by the back wall out of the crowd. Alba can't see anything because everyone is tall, and so I lift her onto my shoulders. She bounces. Claire's family is dispersed, and she's being introduced to a very well-dressed elderly couple by Leah Jacobs, her dealer. Alba says, "I want Mama." "Mama's busy, Alba," I say. I'm feeling queasy. I bend over and set Alba on the floor. She puts her arms up. "No, I want Mama." I sit on the floor and put my head between my knees. I need to find a place where no one can see me. Alba is pulling my ear. "Don't, Alba," I say. I look up. My father is making his way to us through the crowd. "Go," I tell Alba. I give her a little push. "Go see Grandpa." She starts to whimper. "I don't see Grandpa. I want Mama." I'm crawling toward Dad. I bump into someone's legs. I hear Alba screaming, "Mama," as I vanish.
There are masses of people. Everyone presses at me, smiling. I smile at them. The show looks great, and it's done. It's up. I'm so happy and so tired. My face hurts from smiling. Everyone I know is here. I'm talking to Celia when I hear a commotion at the back of the gallery, and then I hear Alba screaming, "Mama!" Where is Henry? I try to get through the crowd to Alba. Then I see her. Richard has lifted her up. People part to let me through. Richard hands Alba to me. She locks her legs around my waist, buries her face in my shoulder, wraps her arms around my neck. Where's Daddy? I ask her softly. Gone, says Alba. Not your mort. Sunday, July 11th, 2004. Claire is 33. Henry is 41. Henry is sleeping, bruised and caked with blood on the kitchen floor. I don't want to move him or wake him. I sit with him on the cool linoleum for a while. Eventually, I get up and make coffee. As the coffee streams into the pot and the grounds make little exploding puffs, Henry whimpers and puts his hands over his eyes. It's obvious that he has been beaten. One eye is swollen shut. The blood seems to have come from his nose. I don't see any wounds, just radiant purple fist-sized bruises all over his body. He is very thin. I can see all his vertebrae and ribs. His pelvis juts. His cheeks are hollow. His hair has grown down almost to his shoulders. There is gray shot through it. There are cuts on his hands and feet, and insect bites everywhere on his body. He is very tanned and filthy, grime under nails, dirt sweated into creases of his skin. He smells of grass, blood, and salt. After watching him and sitting with him for a while, I decide to wake him. Henry, I say very softly, wake up now, you're home. I stroke his face, carefully, and he opens his eye. I can tell he's not quite awake. Claire, he mumbles. Claire. Tears begin to stream from his good eye. He is shaking with sobbing, and I pull him into my lap. I am crying. Henry is curled in my lap, there on the floor. We shake tightly together, rocking, rocking, crying our relief and our anguish together. Thursday, December 23rd, 2004. Claire is 33. Henry is 41. It's the day before Christmas Eve. Henry is at Water Tower Place taking Alba to see Santa at Marshall Fields while I finish the shopping. Now I'm sitting in the cafe at Borders, drinking cappuccino at a table by the front window and resting my feet with a pile of bulging shopping bags leaning against my chair. Outside the window, the day is fading and tiny white lights describe every tree. Shoppers hurry up and down Michigan Avenue, and I can hear the muted clang of the Salvation Army Santa's bell below me. I turn back to the store, scanning for Henry and Alba, and someone calls my name. Kendrick is coming toward me with his wife, Nancy, and Colin and Nadia in tow. I can see at a glance that they've just come from FAO Schwartz. They have the shell-shocked look of parents freshly escaped from toy store hell. Nadia comes running up to me, squealing, Aunt Claire! Aunt Claire! Where's Alba? Colin smiles shyly and holds out his hand to show me that he has a tiny yellow tow truck. I congratulate him and tell Nadia that Alba's visiting Santa, and Nadia replies that she already saw Santa last week. What did you ask for? I query. A boyfriend, says Nadia. She's 3 years old. I grin at Kendrick and Nancy. Kendrick says something, sotto voce, to Nancy, and she says, Come on, troops, we have to find a book for Aunt Sylvie. And the three of them go pelting off to the bargain tables. Kendrick gestures at the empty chair across from me. May I? Sure. He sits down, sighing deeply. I hate Christmas. You and Henry both. Does he? I didn't know that. Kendrick leans against the window and closes his eyes. Just as I think that he's actually asleep, he opens them and says, Is Henry following his drug regimen? I guess. I mean, as closely as he can, considering that he's been time-traveling a lot lately. Kendrick drums his fingers on the table. How much is a lot? Every couple days. Kendrick looks furious. Why doesn't he tell me these things? I think he's afraid you'll get upset with him and quit. He's the only test subject I have who can talk, and he never tells me anything. I laugh. Join the club. Kendrick says, I'm trying to do science. I need him to tell me when something doesn't work. Otherwise, we're all just spinning our wheels. I nod. Outside, it has started to snow. Claire? Hmm? Why won't you let me look at Alba's DNA? I've had this conversation 100 times with Henry. Because first you'd just want to locate all the markers in her genes, and that would be okay. But then you and Henry would start to badger me to let you try out drugs on her, and that is not okay. That's why. But she's still very young. She has a better chance of responding positively to the medication. I said no. When Alba is 18, she can decide for herself. So far, everything you've given Henry has been a nightmare. I can't look at Kendrick. I say this to my hands, tightly folded on the table. But we might be able to develop gene therapy for her. People have died from gene therapy. Kendrick is silent. The noise level in the store is overwhelming. Then from the babble, I hear Alba calling, Mama! I look up and see her riding on Henry's shoulders, clutching his head with her hands. Both of them are wearing coonskin caps. Henry sees Kendrick, and for a brief moment he looks apprehensive, and I wonder what secrets these two men are keeping from me. Then Henry smiles and comes striding toward us, Alba bobbing happily above the crowd. Kendrick rises to greet him, and I push the thought away.
Birthday. Wednesday, May 24th, 1989. Henry is 41. Claire is 18. I come to with a thud and skid across the painful stubble of the meadow on my side, ending up dirty and bloody at Claire's feet. She is sitting on the rock, coolly immaculate in a white silk dress, white stockings and shoes, and short white gloves. Hello, Henry, she says as though I've just dropped in for tea. What's up? I ask. You look like you're on your way to your first communion. Claire sits up very straight and says, Today is May 24th, 1989. I think fast. Happy birthday. Do you happen to have a Bee Gees outfit squirreled away somewhere around here for me? Without deigning to reply, Claire glides off the rock and, reaching behind it, produces a garment bag. With a flourish, she unzips it to reveal a tuxedo, pants, and one of those infernal formal shirts that require studs. She produces a suitcase containing underwear, a cummerbund, a bow tie, studs, and a gardenia. I'm seriously alarmed and not forewarned. I ponder the available data. Claire, we're not getting married today or anything insane like that, are we? Because I know for a fact that our anniversary is in the fall. October, late October. Claire turns away while I'm dressing. You mean you can't remember our anniversary? How male. I sigh. Darling, you know I know, I just can't get at it right now. But anyway, happy birthday. I'm 18. Heavens, so you are. Seems like only yesterday that you were 6. Claire is intrigued, as always, with the notion that I've recently visited some other Claire, older or younger. Have you seen me when I was 6 lately? Well, just now I was lying in bed with you reading Emma. You were 33. I am 41 at the moment and feeling every minute. I comb through my hair with my fingers and run my hand over my stubble. I'm sorry, Claire. I'm afraid I'm not at my best for your birthday. I fasten the gardenia through the buttonhole of the tuxedo and start to do up the studs. I saw you at 6 about 2 weeks ago. You drew me a picture of a duck. Claire blushes. The blush spreads like drops of blood in a bowl of milk. Are you hungry? I made us a feast. Of course I'm hungry. I'm famished, gaunt, and considering cannibalism. That won't be necessary just yet. There's something in her tone that pulls me up. Something is going on that I don't know about, and Claire expects me to know it.
She's practically humming with excitement. I contemplate the relative merits of a simple confession of ignorance versus continuing to fake it. I decide to let it go for a while. Claire is spreading out a blanket, which will later end up on our bed. I carefully sit down on it, and am comforted by its pale green familiarity. Claire unpacks sandwiches, little paper cups, silverware, crackers, a tiny black jar of supermarket caviar, Thin Mint Girl Scout cookies, strawberries, a bottle of Cabernet with a fancy label, brie cheese which looks a bit melted, and paper plates. Claire. Wine. Caviar. I'm impressed and somehow not amused. She hands me the Cabernet and the corkscrew. I don't think I've ever mentioned this, but I'm not supposed to drink. Doctor's orders. Claire looks crestfallen. But I can certainly eat. I can pretend to be drinking. I mean, if that would be helpful. I can't shake the feeling that we're playing house. I didn't know you drank alcohol. I mean, I've hardly ever seen you drink any. Well, I don't really like it, but since this is a momentous occasion, I thought it would be nice to have wine. Champagne probably would have been better, but this was in the pantry, so I brought it along. I open the wine and pour us each a small cup. We toast each other silently. I pretend to sip mine. Claire takes a mouthful, swallows it in a businesslike fashion, and says, "Well, that's not so bad. That's a 20-something dollar bottle of wine." "Oh. Well, that was marvelous." Claire. She's unwrapping dark rye sandwiches which seem to be overflowing with cucumbers. I hate to be obtuse. I mean, obviously it's your birthday, my 18th birthday, she agrees. Well, to begin with, I'm really upset that I don't have a present for you. Claire looks up, surprised. And I realize that I'm warm. I'm on to something here. But you know I never know when I'm coming and I can't bring anything with me. I know all that. But don't you remember? We worked it all out the last time you were here. Because on the list today is the last day left and also my birthday. You don't remember? Claire is looking at me very intently, as though concentration can move memory from her mind to mine. Oh, I haven't been there yet. I mean, that conversation is still in my future. I wonder why I didn't tell you then. I still have lots of dates on the list left to go. Is today really the last day? You know, we'll be meeting each other in the present in a couple of years. We'll see each other then. But that's a long time. For me. There's an awkward pause. It's strange to think that right now, I'm in Chicago, 25 years old, going about my business completely unaware of Claire's existence, and for that matter, oblivious to my own presence here, in this lovely Michigan meadow on a gorgeous spring day, which is the 18th anniversary of her birth. We're using plastic knives to apply caviar to Ritz crackers. For a while, there is much crunching and furious consumption of sandwiches. The conversation seems to have foundered. And then I wonder, for the first time, if perhaps Claire is being entirely truthful with me here. Knowing as she does that I'm on slippery terms with statements that begin, "I never," since I never have a complete inventory of my past handy at any given moment, since my past is inconveniently compounded with my future. We move on to the strawberries. Claire. She smiles innocently. What exactly did we decide the last time you saw me? What were we planning to do for your birthday? She's blushing again. Well, this, she says, gesturing at her picnic. Anything else? I mean, this is wonderful. Well, yes. I'm all ears, because I think I know what's coming. Yes? Claire is quite pink, but manages to look otherwise dignified as she says, "We decided to make love." Ah, I have, actually, always wondered about Claire's sexual experiences prior to October 26, 1991, when we met for the first time in the present. Despite some pretty amazing provocation on Claire's part, I have refused to make love to her,
and have spent many amusing hours chatting with her about this and that while trying to ignore painful hard-ons. But today, Claire is legally, if perhaps not emotionally, an adult. And surely I can't warp her life too much. That is to say, I've already given her a pretty weird childhood just by being in her childhood at all. How many girls have their very own eventual husband appearing at regular intervals, buck naked before their eyes? Claire is watching me think this through. I'm thinking about the first time I made love to Claire, and wondering if it was the first time she made love to me. I decide to ask her about this when I get back to my present. Meanwhile, Claire is tidying things back into the picnic basket. So? What the hell? Yes. Claire is excited and also scared. Henry, you've made love to me lots of times. Many, many times. She's having trouble saying it. It's always beautiful, I tell her. It's the most beautiful thing in my life. I'll be very gentle. Having said this, I'm suddenly nervous. I'm feeling responsible and Humbertish, and also as though I'm being watched by many people, and all of those people are Claire. I've never felt less sexual in my life. Okay. Deep breath. I love you. We both stand up, lurching a bit on the uneven surface of the blanket. I open my arms and Claire moves into them. We stand, still, embracing there in the meadow like the bride and groom on top of a wedding cake. And after all, this is Claire. Come to my 41-year-old self almost as she was when we first met. No fear. She leans her head back. I lean forward and kiss her. Claire? You're absolutely sure we're alone? Everyone except Etta and Nell is in Kalamazoo. Because I feel like I'm on candid camera here. Paranoid. Very sad. Never mind. We can go to my room. Too dangerous. God, it's like being in high school. What? Never mind. Claire steps back from me and unzips her dress. She pulls it over her head and drops it on the blanket with admirable unconcern. She steps out of her shoes and peels off her stockings. She unhooks her bra, discards it, and steps out of her panties. She is standing before me completely naked. It's sort of a miracle. All the little marks I've become fond of have vanished. Her stomach is flat. No trace of the pregnancies that will bring us such grief, such happiness. This Claire is a little thinner and a lot more buoyant than the Claire I love in the present. I realize again how much sadness has overtaken us. But today all of that is magically removed. Today the possibility of joy is close to us. I kneel, and Claire comes over and stands in front of me. I press my face to her stomach for a moment and then look up. Claire is towering over me, her hands in my hair with the cloudless blue sky around her. I shrug off my jacket and undo the tie. Claire kneels and we remove the studs deftly and with the concentration of a bomb squad. I take off the pants and underwear. There's no way to do this gracefully. I wonder how male strippers deal with this problem. Or do they just hop around on stage, one leg in, one out? Claire laughs. I've never seen you get undressed. Not a pretty sight. You wound me. Come here and let me wipe that smirk off your face. Uh-oh. In the next 15 minutes, I'm proud to say that I have indeed removed all traces of superiority from Claire's face. Unfortunately, she's getting more and more tense, more defended. In 14 years, and heaven only knows how many hours and days spent happily, anxiously, urgently, languorously making love with Claire, this is utterly new to me. I want, if at all possible, for her to feel the sense of wonder I felt when I met her and we made love for what I thought, silly me, was the first time. I sit up, panting. Claire sits up as well and circles her arms around her knees protectively. You okay? I'm afraid. That's okay. I'm thinking. I swear to you that the next time we meet, you're going to practically rape me. I mean, you are really exceptionally talented at this.
I am?
You are incandescent. I'm rummaging through the picnic basket. Cups, wines, condoms, towels. Clever girl. I pour us each a cup of wine. To virginity. Had we but world enough and time. Drink up. She does obediently, like a small child taking medicine. I refill her cup and down my own.
But you aren't supposed to drink.
It's a momentous occasion. Bottoms up. Claire weighs about 120 pounds, but these are Dixie cups. One more.
More? I'll get sleepy.
You'll relax. She gulps it down. We squash up the cups and throw them in the picnic basket. I lie down on my back with my arms stretched out like a sunbather or a crucifixion. Claire stretches out beside me. I gather her in so that we're side by side, facing each other. Her hair falls across her shoulders and breasts in a very beautiful and touching way, and I wish for the zillionth time that I was a painter. Claire?
Hmm?
Imagine yourself as open. Empty. Someone's come along and taken out all your innards and left only nerve endings. I've got the tip of my index finger on her clit.
Poor little Claire.
No innards. Ah, but it's a good thing, you see, because there's all this extra room in there. Think of all the stuff you could put inside you if you didn't have all those silly kidneys and stomachs and pancreases and whatnot.
Like what?
She's very wet. I remove my hand and carefully rip open the condom packet with my teeth, a maneuver I haven't performed in years. Kangaroos, toaster ovens, penises. Claire takes the condom from me with fascinated distaste. She's lying on her back and she unfurls it and sniffs it.
Ugh, must we?
Although I often refuse to tell Claire things, I seldom actually lie to her. I feel a twinge of guilt as I say, "Afraid so." I retrieve it from her, but instead of putting it on, I decide what we really need here is cunnilingus. Claire and her future is addicted to oral sex and will leap tall buildings in a single bound and wash the dishes when it's not her turn in order to get it. If cunnilingus were an Olympic event, I would medal, no doubt about it. I spread her out and apply my tongue to her clit.
"Oh, God,"
Claire says in a low voice.
"Sweet Jesus,
no yelling," I warn. Even Edda and Nell will come down to the meadow to see what's wrong if Claire really gets going. In the next 15 minutes, I take Claire several steps down the evolutionary ladder until she's pretty much a limbic core with a few cerebral cortex peripherals. I roll on the condom and slowly, carefully, slide into Claire, imagining things breaking and blood cascading around me. She has her eyes closed, and at first I think she's not even aware that I'm actually inside her, even though I'm directly over her. But then she opens her eyes and smiles. Triumphant. Beatific. I manage to come fairly quickly. Claire is watching me, concentrating. And as I come, I see her face turn to surprise. How strange things are. What odd things we animals do. I collapse onto her. We're bathed in sweat. I can feel her heart beating. Or perhaps it's mine. I pull out carefully and dispose of the condom. We lie side by side looking at the very blue sky. The wind is making a sea sound with the grass. I look over at Claire. She looks a bit stunned.
"Hey.
Claire."
"Hey,"
she says weakly. "Did it hurt?"
"Yes."
"Did you like it?"
"Oh, yes,"
she says and starts to cry. We sit up and I hold her for a while. She's shaking.
"Claire, Claire, what's wrong?"
I can't make out her reply at first, then,
"You're going away." Now I won't see you for years and years. Only 2 years. 2 years and a few months. She's quiet.
Oh, God.